Good morning and welcome. This happens to be the 10th anniversary of the very first service that was ever held in this room, and that's a special occasion for us. It is our custom here to remind visitors and ourselves, for that matter, that we are committed to avoiding discrimination based on gender, age, income and wealth, sexual orientation, political affiliation, ethnicity, education, or most anything else. If this is your first time with us and you find our values attractive, we hope it will not be your last time here. The back of the Sunday bulletin includes information about the principles that guide our approach to each other and to the world we share with 7 billion other humans and millions of other plants and animals that sustain us and them. You can learn about upcoming events in the bulletin. Even more information about us is available in our monthly newsletter, copies of which are available in the narthex, as well as at our website, uufm.net. An even better way to learn about this fellowship is to stick around following the service for light refreshments and conversation with anyone wearing a name tag. There are announcements in the order of service. In addition, I have this one. The swing dancers will begin again this coming Tuesday, the 12th of June at 6:30 p.m. Those are the announcements. This morning, as we are mindful of significant passages. Last week, two longtime members died. June Kermser, who helped to found this group 55 years ago, and Doris Grosch, who first joined the fellowship about 45 years ago. Both of them and their spouses have played important roles in helping to build this facility and to shape the activities that occur within and near these walls. Their outstanding contributions to the wider community made us proud to claim them as our members. In addition, three young couples who have been with us for altogether too short a time, Katie and Ryan Meyer, Melissa and David McKee, Sarah Nuss-Warren, and Chris Nakamura, have left or soon will do so for new jobs in Texas, Chicago, and Michigan. Catherine Lawrence, beloved for her willingness to sing either soprano or alto, whichever was needed in the choir, who added to our appreciation for therapeutic uses of the arts, has moved to Lawrence. And at least four other members are planning to move far away from Manhattan in the near future. Finally, Lisa Swartz has graced our pulpit at least once a year for the past, I think, 15 years, roughly. 20 years. But who's counting? She will soon depart for her new post as minister of the Winston-Salem UU Fellowship. That congregation's members have no idea just how lucky they are. As we light the chalice this morning, we give thanks for the many ways in which all of them have enriched our lives, just as we tried to do likewise for them. In the months and years to come, may we be mindful that everyone we are losing was once a visitor. Just as our reservoir of energy, wisdom, and generosity of spirit can never be too full, every visitor needs a spiritual home that promotes freedom of conscience and never forgets that there is worth and dignity in every one. Well, maybe we'll light this. It's on the lower shelf. Oh, thank you. Our opening hymn is number 203, All Creatures of the Earth and Sky. Please stand as you are able and join with us in singing it.
All creatures of the earth and sky.
This is the time in a service when we share our joys and concerns that we wish to share, and a microphone is circulating around here. Please use it so that people with headsets can hear.
Morning, my name is Tom Phillips, and I'm ecstatic to announce that Stacy Brofman and I are engaged to be married.
All right.
In less than 4 months. Anything you'd like to say, dear? I guess not. Okay, she's speechless. And I did also to say that this fellowship has been a wonderful group for the world, for our community, and particularly for Stacy and me, and we intend to stay here a long time. Thank you.
Les Frazier, I have a concern. Many of you, if not most of you, have signed a petition, I have one, to get Rush Limbaugh off the air. We have one local sponsor. If you want to sign a petition, see me.
Our son, Paul, celebrated his 40th birthday last night at a concert, and the artist was, help me out, Kathleen.
Barry Manilow.
And he said the great thing about it, besides the wonderful music, was that he lowered the average age of the audience. Any others? All right, we'll move on to the anthem.
Well, I kind of forgot how far it is from Topeka to Lawrence, to Manhattan. Well, maybe that was part of the problem. I was afraid Michael would have to introduce me as the late Lisa Schwartz, and I apologize for anyone I blasted past on my way in. The Nobel laureate Leon Lederman has a story about how the universe began, and he barely gets into the story when he stops and says, "Wait, before I get too far, I should explain that I really don't know what I'm talking about." A story logically begins at the beginning, but this story is about the universe, and unfortunately, there are no data for the very beginning, capital V, capital B, none, zero. So when you read or hear anything about the birth of the universe, someone is making it up. So my UU minister colleague, Carol Martignacco, is in good company in marrying science and philosophy. Here's her version of how you and I and everything that is came to be. Have you ever watched a seed grow? Have you ever noticed how it begins so small, so still, so quiet, like a gift waiting to be opened, and how slowly it wakes up, begins to unfold, growing into something larger and larger and larger? If you've noticed that, then you know that whatever comes from a seed usually ends up looking very little like the seed it came from, which is also true of the very first seed. Once, long ago, way back before the beginning, so long ago there was no such thing as time because there was no one there to count it, there was really no such thing as space, but we can imagine that everywhere was a huge, deep, mysterious place, like something waiting to happen. There were no stars, no moon, no sun. There was no place like Earth, not a drop of water, not a single tree or rock or flower, no living beings anywhere. But in that deep waiting space was hidden the tiniest point of something no bigger than a seed. Not a flower seed or an elm tree seed, not a seed of corn, although all those things were included in the first seed. You might call it an everything seed because that was what it became. No one knows where that first seed came from or how it was planted, or how it knew in the way that only seeds seem to know, how long to wait for just the right moment to sprout and grow. But all at once, this tiny seed, cradled and nourished in the rich soil of space, woke up, broke open, and began to unfold. Unfolding and blossoming forth into an enormous blazing ball of bright light like a great grandmother sun. And the universe was born. Out fluttered the galaxies, like a storm of snowflakes swirling and gathering into the brightest, most blindingly beautiful clouds of stars. And out of those star clouds whirled our own star, the one we call the sun, and our Earth, and the moon, and all the round spinning planets we've learned how to name. And this is the secret of that tiny seed. You and I were there in the very beginning. Just as the idea for each leaf on a big oak tree lies hidden inside an acorn, We were there with all the stars and planets and rocks and oceans and plants and animals and people. Everything that is now or ever was or ever will be was inside that first tiny seed. So whenever you hold a seed in your hand and wonder what it could become, imagine how you and all that is here once came from the tiniest speck of an everything seed before it sprouted and grew long, long ago in the way back beginning of time. Now, if this were an ordinary story, it would end right here. But this story of the universe keeps unfolding. What once began in a blazing blossom of light continues every day. New stars sprout open in the deep soil of space. New plants and animals appear on Earth. Seeds of so many kinds are scattered all over the earth to help us remember and new people are born every day with the spark of that first light still alive and burning deep inside, waiting like the everything seed to shine in ways that are yet to be known.
The second Sunday of each month, our collection goes to some entity that goes through the arduous task of passing our barriers and getting to a right to do that. This month, it is a group that we have sponsored for years and does wonderful work. And they will hear a little bit about it, and then we'll pass the basket.
Good morning to you, and thank you, Lisa, for the wonderful description of our creation, of this beautiful land we have here today. The skies are sunny. The rain might be coming this afternoon, but we have a beautiful breeze, so that'll make the day even better. And Michael, I have to comment on something you said at the beginning also. You mentioned that you are here to give worth and dignity to everyone. And I commend you for that. That's pretty much an example of what Shepherd's Crossing wants to be an example of also. My name is Beverly Olson, the director at Shepherd's Crossing. I just want to give you, first of all, our words of mission. Shepherd's Crossing mission is to provide compassionate and caring assistance to those in need of a listening ear and financial support. I'm going to give you a few statistics this morning, so hold on to your mental part of the brain that helps you calculate those things, okay? First of all, I'd like to tell you and remind you that a part of Shepherd's Crossing assistance is a budget counseling. Anyone and everyone who comes to Shepherd's Crossing and asks for some kind of financial assistance, we do a budget counseling. Now, it's not 2 months long or anything like that. It's usually about a half hour thing, but we go through their income and we go through their expenses and we try to see where they might be able to cut down on one thing or another. So we kind of pride ourselves because we've got some wonderful volunteer counselors who have been school teachers and business owners, and you know they know how to put the pressure on when somebody's not towing the budget really good. So, but I'm going to give you some figures here. In 2011, we passed out over $140,000 worth of funds to help people with rent, utilities, prescriptions. $140,000. That equaled to about 1,200 different clients, different households. Now, you can pretty much sit and average that out. That's about 120, 25 or so per household. I must tell you, though, that we had a couple of hundred of them that, because we require, if they have a $500 rent bill and we can only help them with $125, $150, they must bring us a receipt to show they have paid the $350 first. We had over 200 that could not bring back a receipt saying they had already paid that. They found help elsewhere, don't know where. Maybe they worked something out with the landlord, don't know. So those kind of situations kind of break my heart because I know we haven't been able to help them with more. I'll give you a few more numbers. Over 54,000 went for rent to landlords. This is just Riley County. West Star, over 61,000. Kansas Gas, over 16,000. Water and propane, over 6,000. We have in Riley County, believe it or not, and if you read the newspapers, you probably know it. If you don't read the newspapers and just look around like you're a visitor, you wouldn't know that we have over 20% of our population are in a poverty situation. They have maybe $1,000 a month and pays $450, $500 for rent. How much is your mortgage? How much is your rent? And then they have to pay their food, and then they have to pay their utilities. And what if they've got an expensive prescription? What do they go without? So every 4 months, we can ask them to come back in, and we can help them with something like that. But we do not ever give the money to them. It always goes to the landlord, goes to Westar, goes to the water company, propane company. So be assured our funds are well used and well governed. We not only help folks with money, but we also help them with other things. Encore Shop and Budget Shop allow us to give vouchers to folks so that they do not have to pay for the secondhand clothes that they would like to have from the Encore Shop or Budget Shop. And what's really cool is they reciprocate that Encore and Budget Shop, send money back to us after they get their sales. So it's a big circle of love. Lions Club, we sent over 20 different requests for glasses to Lions Club last year. And if you're not familiar with the Fairy Godmothers program, anybody shake their head that they know about it? Okay, there's a few. Ask a few of the ladies and they'll fill you in. We sent over 40 requests last year for Fairy Godmothers. And this is helping women helping women. Awesome, awesome program. We are so blessed to be able to help them that way. The day-to-day operations are intricate to us because what we have to supply to the grant companies, to you as churches, to the city of Manhattan even, is very, very detailed. We have to show by very clear numbers, and I've given you a few of those already, that we're using the monies properly for the folks. And our program is designed so that our administrative expenses are kept to under 20%, which we really work hard at doing that. I am part-time director. I have one more part-time person. Everyone else volunteers. And, of course, the First United Methodist Church allows us to use their facility rent-free, so that helps with finances also. I want to give you just a quick story about a gentleman who came in. He was a veteran. He had a low income, low veteran's income. He was working a part-time job, too. Couldn't quite make things happen to get enough income, so he came to us once in a while for some help. But one day, one of the counselors realized that he was picking up the paper and bringing it up close. You know, we've seen that happen before. And she said, "Looks like you need glasses. Did you forget them?" And he said, "No, I couldn't afford glasses. That's way too expensive." Well, we started talking with him a little bit closer. He shared with us that he had a friend. And his friend called us. His friend was willing to help with a little bit of money towards his glasses. We requested help with the Lions Club. Actually, some of our counselors put monies together, and we were able to gather over $300 to help with Lions Club and the eye doctor and the glasses. And you can't imagine how thrilling it was when he walked in the door one day not an appointment to ask for anything. He said, "Look, everybody, I can see you." So those kind of things warm our hearts, and not that we spent any money of yours to help this man, but we spent our time. We were able to give compassionate, caring assistance to them. Want you to also know that I'll be back at the table. We love money from the churches, but we really love those from individuals. Churches last month gave us about $6,000. Now calculate that out at the $120 a month, or 120 or so. We had almost 100 clients last month. We didn't have enough from churches. We needed like 12,000 to make the budget. So the individuals that send us money, we have some organizations. You might have heard about the K-State Alumni Association. It's on the newsletter in the back there. And I will be back there after your service, and I'm so glad to be a part of your program today. Thank you.
I'll remind you that cash and everything, every check that's not specifically earmarked for the congregation goes to support this cause.
Close him up again. There's a slideshow we're going to do during this. Yes. In fact, while he's closing him, let me tell you something about this first slide. I think it's fascinating that there was a very dark place in the universe, a place where astronomers believed there was nothing. They believed they'd found nothingness, emptiness. And so they focused
a long lens of a telescope on this nothingness. And they said it would be as if you had 10 feet of a drinking straw and were looking through it. That's the small part of absolute blackness that they saw. And they focused it there for, I think it was days. And what they saw when they looked was not stars, but galaxies. If you can look closely, you can see that these little bright spots are not just stars. They're amazing swirling galaxies. This is the deep space picture. Michael and I will read alternately and hope that one side of you, let's say this far side, will read with Michael. This is number 530 in the back of your gray hymnal, and we hope you can see pretty well in this dark.
Maybe the little bit of light here.
All right.
Yeah.
That's a good compromise.
Okay.
We're nothing if not compromisers, right?
You're first, okay.
And then, well, you start out with the boldface type,
oh,
and I'll start
face.
Out
okay.
with the italics.
All right.
And we'll read in response.
All right. Out of the stars in their flight, of the dust of their eternity, here have we come, stardust and sunlight mingling through time and through space.
Out of the stars have we come, up from time. Out of the stars have we come.
Time out of time, before time, in the vastness of space, Earth spun to orbit the sun, Earth with the thunder of mountains newborn, the boiling of seas.
Earth warmed by sun, lit by sunlight. This is our home. Out of the stars have we come.
Mystery hidden in mystery, back through all time. Mystery rising from rocks in the storm and the sea.
Out of the stars, rising from rocks and the sea, kindled by sunlight on earth, arose life.
Ponder this thing in your heart. Ponder with awe. Out of the sea to the land, out of the shallows came ferns.
Out of the sea to the land, up from darkness to light, rising to walk and to fly, out of the sea trembled life.
Ponder this thing in your heart, life up from sea, eyes to behold, throats to sing, mates to love.
Life from the sea, warmed by sun, washed by rain, life from within, giving birth. Rose to love.
This is the marvel of time. This is the marvel of space. Out of stars swung the earth. Life upon earth rose to love.
This is the marvel of life, rising to see and to know. Out of your heart cry, wonder, sing that we live.
Can we open the cards now?
No, because there's going to be a... slide. Okay. The slideshow's a little longer than I thought it was. This is heavy on shots of Wyoming. I went there a few years ago and found it was not the land of Oz, but the land of wows. Well, I'll begin as this is completing. At the dawn of time, everything the universe needed to compose you was already there. And likewise, everything the universe needed to knit together the person sitting next to you was already there. You and your neighbor have been together, have been connected since before the beginning of time. So this moment is a kind of reunion. There's already a profound connection between us. Between you, between me, between everyone and everything. We've been together throughout eternity. Maybe that's why, from the first time I came to speak here about 20 years ago, I felt such a kinship with this congregation. I was still in seminary then, and you were very generous to let me speak every year. And somehow, it's been easy to feel at home here all those years. Now, you've seen me over the years in various robed garbs, kind of clerical officialness, and so maybe it's hard to imagine that I haven't always felt at home in church. Picture this. It's 1973. I am 14 years old. Since I know I will be a psychologist when I grow up, I've started reading Psychology Today. I think it'll give me a leg up when I get to graduate school. And in the pages of that magazine, I find an article reporting that both the American Psychiatric Association and the American Psychological Association have changed their minds about homosexuality. No longer do psychologists and psychiatrists consider being gay a mental illness. It's just another way to be human. In 1973, this is earth-shattering stuff. And at 14, I know this changes everything. I take the article to my dad, a Presbyterian minister. He's a pretty progressive guy for Presbyterian minister. And I say, "Dad, look at this. I guess this means the Presbyterian Church will change its position on homosexuality too." Well, my dad looked distinctly uncomfortable. He hemmed, hawed. He tells me, "No, the church has its own ideas. The church's truth exists apart from social science." And I am outraged. The disconnect between science and dogma is one of the forces that propels me out of the church altogether. Had I known then what I know now, I would have found the nearest UU congregation immediately. I didn't know. And so it was about 10 years later when my boyfriend invited me to his UU fellowship. I said, "Sorry, I'm not interested. I'm not a church kind of girl." Okay, so the universe has a sense of humor. I finally succumbed to the boyfriend's charms long enough to go to the UU fellowship with him on a Sunday, and I wasn't prepared for what I found. Three members of the fellowship were speaking on a panel. They spoke of the winding paths and doubts and disappointments and the joy of discovery of their own spiritual journeys. I had never heard of a spiritual journey. And I was in that place where there were three strikingly different journey stories, and they were all celebrated. And there I had a revelation. I was at home in that congregation. That was the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Topeka, and I guess it stuck. Nearly 30 years now I've been there, and 26 I've been married to that boyfriend. Now I know in a scientific sense, as well as a profoundly spiritual one, that I'd been together with those people a long time. No wonder I felt at home there. And that's a scientific spiritual truth that's key to my faith. This vast interconnected web of existence begun 14 billion years ago with a great flaring forth has coalesced disparate, diverse elements into such a wonderful variety of creatures and communities. Annie Dillard says the world is fashioned with an exuberance that would seem to be unwarranted, and with an abandoned energy sprung from an unfathomable font. And it's not that it all fits together like clockwork, for it doesn't particularly, but that it all flows so freely wild, that it all surges in such a free, fringed tangle. For me, I can find deep meaning in lots of different spiritual symbols, but this one, this picture, is especially sacred It's now familiar to us. It's the picture taken of the Earth from space, probably around 1970. And some of you have grown up with this picture. Many of us, I guess, were born before this picture existed, which is an awesome thought for those of us who were born before this awareness. In our lifetime, it became possible for Earth to regard itself from a distance and see itself as part of a connected whole. When we first saw Earth with no national divisions, no tribal barriers, no religious differences, just a vast single organism. This was a kind of collective spiritual awakening. It was a moment of absolute wonder. Brian Swim is a mathematical cosmologist. He says wonder is a gateway through which the universe floods in and takes up residence within us. And it is wonderful to realize that we're part of Earth, quite literally made from Earth. Alan Watts says that humans grow out of Earth the way apples grow out of apple trees. It couldn't be any other way. We are Earth creatures. We're made from the dust and the clay of this planet, which is just the way those ancient myths describe it. You might be familiar with the second chapter, which is the second creation story in the book of Genesis. We think of it as the Garden of Eden story. And in that story, Yahweh gets down on his knees in the mud at the riverbank and fashions a little creature out of the earth and calls it Earth Creature, Adam. We usually say that as a name, Adam, but Adam means literally Earth Creature. So out of the substance of our planet, the Earth creatures, first man and first woman, emerged and found an ideal home, a paradise, just as ideal as if it were created with us in mind. The biologist Ursula Goodenough knows humans were not placed here on Earth, but she imagines what it would have been like if humans had arrived here, say, in a spaceship, finding Earth's deep forests and fleshy fruits and surging oceans and gentle rains and cavorting creatures and dappled sunlight and rich soil to be perfect for human habitation and astonishingly beautiful. This, she says, is how the religious naturalist thinks of our human advent on Earth. We arrived but a moment ago and found it to be perfect for us in every way. And then we came to understand that it is perfect because we arose from it and are part of it. As we sang this morning, Alleluia! Hosanna! Not in the highest, but right here, right now. This religious naturalism that Ursula Goodenough describes, that's the foundation of my faith. It's distinct from the dominant cultural paradigm of our 21st century. It tells me I should be independent. I should be self-sufficient. It tells me that the Earth's bounty exists as a resource for me, and I should use it and tame it and domesticate it. Religious naturalism's groundedness in the interdependent web is a tonic that might heal this toxic elevation of independence to a national ideal, a national idol. I am a humanist, but mine is not a humanism that elevates humanity to a superior, dominating role in nature. I already have so much of a tendency towards arrogance. I don't need to massage that egocentric muscle. When I was a little kid, I was the youngest of three by quite a span of years. I was the surprise, the caboose of the family. And so when I was about five, I was learning to tell time, and I remember saying to my dad, I get the big hand and the little hand, but on your watch, there's this skinny little hand that spins around really fast. And my dad said, oh, that's the second hand. You know how it is. The youngest kid in the family, any youngests here, we get punked a lot, right? And so I thought to myself, now wait a minute, I may be five, but I can count. There's the big hand and the little hand. And then how could this one be the second hand? It's clearly the third hand. I'm not falling for it. Okay, most people would have caught on pretty soon. I was convinced I was right. I had come to the right conclusion. So for a few years, whenever anyone mentioned the second hand, I would translate in my mind, third hand. Just to myself, you know, quietly. It's not like the second hand comes up in conversation very often. So throughout grade school and middle school, whenever anyone would mention a second hand, I'd think to myself, third hand. Okay, so eventually I became convinced not only was I right, but I was the only one who really got it. I thought everybody else had to have been duped as a little kid. They never had that brilliant insight that I did at age five. Okay, I kind of hate to admit it. I got a watch for high school graduation, and people said, oh, look, it has a second hand, third hand. Yes, isn't that nice? I'm kind of blushing a little bit. I don't know if you can see that, but I want you to understand just how committed I can be to being right. Okay, first semester of college, I took a speech class, and the round of speeches was to be no more than 4 minutes long, so the teacher asked, does anyone have a watch with a second hand? Third hand, yes, I do. So I timed that speech, and at the end, I announced that it had been 3 minutes and 47 seconds. And a light went on for me. Seconds. I almost got up and said, hey, everybody, you know why they call this a second hand? And then it hit me. They had known all along. And I felt really ashamed and humiliated. You know, in some dictionaries of the era, I understand that next to the word arrogance, you find my picture in. Ignorance doesn't lead to humiliation, but arrogance does. So for me, that traditional old school humanism that's very invested in being rational, being reasonable, and above all, being right, that's not a good fit. Usually what my ego needs is very different from what my heart needs and what my soul needs. Now, I'm sure some of you can handle that heady intoxicant of being right better than I can, but you can see why I'm excited about the emergence of a fresh, new humanism, something that helps keep me more grounded and more humble. William Murray is a respected UU humanist. He says, in the past, religious humanism has been accused of being dry and sterile and overly rationalistic. Surely not. But he says Unitarian Universalists are both witnesses to and participants in the advent of a new humanism. It's a humanism with a language for reverence and praise and gratitude for our amazing cosmos. And Ursula Goodenough says, when such gratitude flows from our beings, it matters little whether we offer it to God or mystery or coyote or cosmic evolution or Mother Earth. There's a new humanism that respects the advances of science and leaves room for deep yearnings of the spirit, welling up of gratitude. This humanism celebrates the heart and the body as well as the mind. And above all, this new humanism, some call religious naturalism, respects our place in that interdependent web of existence, recognizes we're not meant to dominate or control, but be a dynamic part of Earth. So look at this photograph and think about what it means for all of us to be earth creatures, all of the same substance, earth stuff that has been able to stand back and look at ourselves like a creature with its first wondering gaze into a mirror. A new humanism is emerging because new humans are emerging. Humans who are conscious enough to reflect on the mystery that connects everything that is. And for humanism to ignore new revelations and plod ever onward with a faith that was really developed in the first half of the 20th century, before this awareness existed, that's reminiscent of those other churches whose doctrines and dogma exist apart from new discoveries and fresh understandings. This story of the cosmos is only beginning to be understood. A Nobel laureate says every time we talk about it, we're just making it up. Scientists struggle to make sense of it, philosophers too, and at the same time science explores the story of everything, we can see that this is a sacred story. It's sacred because it's our story, our origin story. It tells us who we are, tells us about our relationship with everything and everyone. And that makes it a deep story. That story that invites us to ponder big questions just as surely as any ancient mythic creation tale. Our species seems hardwired to look for a grand scheme in our existence. The evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins says we have purpose on the brain. And it's possible that natural selection favored early humans who sought a larger purpose, who could imagine or intuit our meaningful place in the grand scheme of things. There's a primitive tribe in South America today who believe the only way to be fully human is to have a sense of the immensity of the universe, because otherwise our existence is just superficial. So these are primitive people, but their intuition has provided the awareness that we needed a photograph to remind us of. Maybe we're catching up to some of our simpler cousins, maybe to some of our earliest ancestors. When we see that cosmic story as our story, we can trace the arc of evolution. Disparate elements becoming complex organisms. Molten rocks to monarch butterflies. Independent individuals to interdependent communities. And the arc of that story invites us to recognize that a supportive and challenging fellowship such as this one is an empowering, transformative force in the world. Now, we're neighbors, and I know some of the ways that this fellowship has reached out into the community and beyond. I've seen one today. You're giving away your offering plate. There are so many ways that you have stood up, spoken out in love and solidarity to make your city and our region a more just and equitable place, and to make our impact on the earth a little more gentle and a little more reverent. And seeing your efforts helps ground me in hope. Hope is a really important attitude to strive for, and it's a really hard state of mind to maintain in any religious faith or spiritual practice. But for those of us humanists who don't expect divine intervention to fix this mess, hope is essential. Think of it. People who practice hopefulness are kind of an immune system who counter the sickness that plagues our world. We can act as agents of healing. Now, maybe you imagine your immune system in your body as sort of a solo fighter pilot. Here I come to save the day. Paul Hawken, the environmentalist and entrepreneur, says actually an immune system is really more like a network. It's like a community that learns as it goes and becomes stronger as it becomes more connected. For humanists, a connected community is essential. Any one of us might be convinced that we're right. We got something that those other people are too dense to understand. That's okay as far as it goes, but that won't change the world. It's our hope that makes us change agents, not our arrogance. Bob Seitz says, hope doesn't do well when it stays inside just you. To be an effective world-changing force, hope has to spread beyond the boundaries of your own feelings. Hope is taught, studied, and proclaimed, but it's also caught, discovered, and experienced. And there is so much at stake. Hope is really important on our tiny, pretty planet. Such a small part of the cosmic scene. It's astonishingly beautiful, and for us, it's a paradise. And here is a self-portrait. Maybe it's helping bring about a species-wide moment of self-reflection, a self-assessment. That is an evolutionary advance of monumental proportions. Lewis Mumford says, every transformation of humanity has rested upon deep stirrings of the intuition, whose expression amounts to a new vision of the cosmos and the nature of humanity. So this awareness is nothing less than an evolutionary leap forward. It's not physical evolution, but it's cultural evolution, and most definitely spiritual evolution. And if you look closely, you can begin to see the effects of this evolutionary change just as surely as if you could see the human backbone elongating, pelvises tilting, human animals rising up from all fours to stand erect. And just as with that earlier evolutionary shift, our new stance dramatically increases our vision, and that carries us forward on this unfolding journey. Brian Swim says, perhaps our destiny has something to do with this desire to journey and experience the depths of things. Perhaps that's why we're here, to drink so deeply of the powers of the universe, we become the human form of the universe, becoming not just nation-state people, but universe people, becoming a form of human being that is as natural to the universe as the stars or the oceans, knowing how we belong and where we belong so that we enhance the flourishing of the Earth community. Because the story of the universe doesn't end with us. We're part of its continuing unfolding. Remember those words of Carol Martignacco in The Everything Seed, what once began in a blazing blossom of light continues every day, waiting to shine in ways that are yet to be known. The alluring, stupendously creative universe calls to us and offers us a choice. We can choose to participate in the healing and rejuvenation of our planet and our own lives. And we can choose not to. And if we choose not to, we're not condemned as sinners. But boy, we're missing out on an amazing opportunity. A new scientific understanding is evolving, and it's emerging hand in hand with a new spiritual understanding, an awareness of our interdependence with each other and with every part of our planet and with the vast embracing cosmos itself. Can we cultivate that sense of deep seeing so that each small gift fills us with wonder and gratitude and humility? If it's possible for us, then it's possible for all humanity. And if it's possible for all humanity, then there is a new hope for Earth and for that whole interdependent web of life of which we're but a small part. May our imaginations be open to the spirit of holiness that surrounds us. I think we have some time for discussion and perhaps a microphone to come to you so all may hear your comments and questions. Just a couple.
Les Frazier, that was very good. You're a thinker. I agree with you that we came from the dust. Are we more than dust? Are we spiritual? Do we have a soul? And if so, you said we don't know where the earth came from, and I agree with you. We don't know. Nobody knows. Do we also not know where the spirit or the soul comes from? And if there is a, if we have a soul, and if we have a spirit, not only where did it come from, but where does it go? You cannot create or destroy matter. Is it something? If it is something in us, in addition to dust, some people would say, well, reincarnation. Other people say, it's going to heaven. Do you have thoughts on this?
I think, yeah, this would be a sermon series, perhaps, on this. I would commend to you the book Sum, S-U-M. It's by a neurologist who's written, I think, about 40 different ideas of what the afterlife is like. My favorite is when he says, you know, that when an army battalion, say, breaks up at the end of a war, they've been part of something larger than it themselves. Can you even imagine that the component atoms, which, as you say, you can't destroy matter, the component atoms, as they move apart, might have just a moment of regret, knowing that there was something larger than themselves they were a part of? I don't know. It's a wonderful book, Sum, S-U-M. Okay, we're going to move on to the next comment. I think somebody else has the microphone already.
Okay, here's true confession time. I'm a second, third-hand person, too.
Okay.
It took me a long time to figure it out.
I'm glad I'm not the only one. Oh, I've left you speechless. That's amazing. All right.
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa. You can do the closing words, if you will. We are inaugurating the use of what goes by the name of the Teal Hymnal, and we're going to sing 1074. I'm going to ask all the choir members who are willing to do so to come forward and help to lead the song. The tune is familiar, but the rhythm is a little different, and so we're going to do it our way. You can do it your way if you want, but we'll be somewhat consistent here. I'd notice, and there's quite a bit of an interlude between each verse, but we'll do something so that you will know when that interlude is over, if you can't follow it. And notice, like at the top of page 2, there's a rest that you have to take, and there are some other things like that. And now we are all on our own, except we're all in this together. Marilyn, if you'll get us started.
Thank you.
Mystery hidden in mystery back through all time. This is the marvel of life, rising to see and to know and to love. I am grateful for the mystery that has brought us together for a part of this journey. Out of your heart, cry, wonder, sing that we live. Amen and blessed be.